Psalm 90, speaking of divine favor, maybe you've heard the word favor before. Who are the people that you tend to be favorably disposed toward? Who are the people that have treated you favorably in your life? Here's my guess, because it's true of all of us. We tend to treat people favorably that measure up to our standards. Now, our standards may not all be the same, but each of us has conscious or subconscious standards of other people. And when we associate with other people, we befriend people, we marry that special person, we invite people into our homes, it's because they've attained some measure of standing in our lives, in our minds, in our eyes. We tend to show favor to the people that are favorable. But this is why God is so radically different than us. Here's what God does. God shows favor to those that acknowledge that they are far less than Him, that they are unworthy of Him, that they are broken before Him. God takes the lowly and elevates them. God takes the broken and heals them. God takes those that realize they're not worthy of being exalted and He exalts them. I'm thinking of a godly man in the New Testament. This godly man had such a handle on his life's mission that he was able to say in John 3:30, what did he say? Do you remember his name? John the Baptist, the cousin of Jesus. He said this, speaking of Christ, "He must increase, but I must decrease." It's like, there's his eureka moment. He got it. He understood it. So much of life outside of Scripture teaches us that the way to get ahead is to exalt yourself, to be number one, to be number one at school, to self-promote, to take life by the tail. It says you can do it. You can do it. Just do it. Positive thinking. But the message of Scripture doesn't align with that. The message of Scripture is He must increase. We must decrease. But here's what God then does. When we decrease, God exalts us. We're going to see this same notion in Psalm 90. In Psalm 90, I'll just put it to you this way. These are my own words. The lower we go, the higher we go. The lower we go, the higher we go. The more we submit, the more we surrender, the more we acknowledge our finite state and God's infinite glory, the more God exalts us, fills us with hope, heals us, puts us on mission, fills our lives with purpose, and eradicates our fear. We're going to see this in this psalm. Think of it this way. You're in a theater, and the star of the show is about to come out on the stage. What do they do with the lighting? They dim the lighting in the audience. So we're the audience, all of us together. They dim the lighting. It gets dark in the room. You can hardly see the person next to you. And then the stage is lit up, and the star comes out on the stage, and everybody's attention through the whole play is focused on the star. You're not thinking a whole lot about the people around you unless they're causing noise. You're thinking about the star on the stage. That is the Christian life. It's we're in the dark. All of us are looking forward. The light's not on me. It's not on you. It's not on the person next to you. The light is on God. And we focus on Him. We look to Him for guidance and direction. And when we do that, God encourages us and lifts us up. So has God granted us favor, church? Yes or no? He's granted us favor. Check out the first couple verses here of Psalm 90. Lord, these could be our words. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or even had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Let's read it again. Lord, you've been our dwelling place. How long has He been our dwelling place for? In all generations. Never skips a generation. never wanders off and forgets about us, never lets us go. God has always and forever been true to his people from every generation since the world was first created. Before the mountains were brought forth, before there was even stuff, before there was anything that you could taste or touch or feel or see, before there was any it, there was him, the God of the universe. And that God has manifested himself to us and been faithful. How many of you love the outdoors on a good day? You love the outdoors. Some beautiful stuff. You love to hike. You love to go swimming in an outdoor lake. You love to ride your bike along the waterfront. You love to go for a walk in the park. You love to camp. You love to see nature. Outdoors is pretty awesome. But we never say to one another, well, I just returned from being inside. We always say, I just returned from being outside. Because outside is not our home. That's not our dwelling place. We enjoy it. There's beauty there. But my bed isn't out in the back lawn. My refrigerator isn't out in the rear field. We don't have dinner out in the back 40. We always return to our dwelling place, to our home. Home's our place of safety from the chaos of the world. The world is chaotic. It's beautiful, but it's simultaneously chaotic. You can freeze to death out there. You can get soaking wet out there. You can get hit by a car out there. You can get shot out there. You can have someone that doesn't know you take advantage of you out there. But when you come to your home, that's your dwelling place. The home symbolizes security and protection and family. That's where your bed is. That's where your belongings are stored. Now, how is God described in this text? He's described as our dwelling place. He's described as the one who offers protection and blessing and provision and hope. He's our dwelling place. We all know how chaotic this world can be. We've all experienced the scars, the bruises, the challenges of this world. And we've made a mistake, I'm sure all of us have, of trying to find our dwelling place out in the world. And then we're like, it just not capable of it. But God is capable of being our dwelling place, our safe place. And this safe God, this God who is described in verse 1 as our dwelling place, has been our dwelling place for all generations. All generations. There's no generation that has not experienced God as their dwelling place. Meaning that he is over and over and over again faithful. I'll be faithful to you, hopefully most of the time, but I will not be faithful to you all of the time. My broken humanity guarantees that. But God is ever faithful to his people. It is this permanency of God, the permanency of God, that qualifies him to be our eternal dwelling place. I was working on our family budget yesterday, just kind of reviewing some things and making adjustments. Apparently, we didn't have enough grocery money, so I had to hike that one up. There were some other adjustments we had to make, some changes in our insurance and so forth and so on. And just kind of looking down the list of expenditures, and it dawned on me how much money we pay for insurance. We have to insure both of our vehicles. We have to insure our home. I insure my lawn tractor. We have life insurance. No offense to those of you that are in the insurance agency. But it's expensive to stay insured. Why do we need insurance? Because of the perils of life. You're insured against the perils of life. Life insurance, house insurance, car insurance. But God is not insured. The reason why God doesn't require insurance is because God has no perils that can take him down. He is our eternal God. And because he is our eternal God, he is our ultimate insurance and becomes our assurance by faith. That's God. So read it at the gates. The psalmist is declaring this. He's reminding us. He's our eternal dwelling place. He's the one that we go to for hope and for comfort and for peace. And it is this God that provides for his people over and over again. Today we're going to dedicate our new auditorium to the Lord. Pray that it doesn't rain. Why would we dedicate something that doesn't last? Why would we do that? Why would we dedicate something to the Lord that we know is going to fall down eventually? I don't know, maybe it'll go up in a ball of fire 10 years from now. Maybe it'll last for 200 years and then fall down. But one thing we know, it will not last forever. Why would we dedicate anything to the Lord that doesn't last? Well, the mountains won't last either. The world won't last. We won't last. But here's the thing about temporary gifts. Temporary gifts are worth honoring God through and because of, because they remind us of the habitual, ongoing, eternal favor of God in a broken world. Suppose we had a building here that was 2,000 years old. Peter and Paul got together and built it in the first century in Windsor, Ontario. And we were here, we got to enjoy it, and hundreds of generations of believers had worshiped in it. In fact, the world comes to worship in it. Nobody has to build buildings. I think we'd appreciate it, but maybe not to the degree when we have to work for it ourselves. Every generation has to work under the authority of God to build churches, to build ministries, to share the gospel. That requires faithfulness. It doesn't require faithfulness if you already have something. But it requires faith when you don't have, and you have to pray, and you have to wait, and you have to work, and you have to give, and you have to wait some more, and you have to give some more, and you have to work hard. God gives and he takes so that he might receive the praise. Doesn't the Bible teach that? The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. May the name of the Lord be praised. Temporary gifts remind us of the eternal favor of God. He keeps replacing that which is temporary to prove to us that he continues to favor us generation after generation. Consider your own life. This is the direction the text is taking us in. Consider your own life as a prime example of this. Our lives don't last very long, but we're still very thankful for them. We're thankful for one another. We're thankful for the people that God brings into our lives, but our lives do not last very long. You can weep and you can mourn for a day, but the temporary nature of life isn't supposed to depress us. It's supposed to delight us in our eternal God who makes all things new, who continues to provide generation after generation to his people. So verses 1 and 2. Here's an arguable truth. God is infinite. God is infinite. What does that mean? He's without boundaries. He's without weakness. He's without deficit. Perils can't take him down. Threats can't take him down. God is infinite. You got it? With that thought firmly embedded in your mind, look where God takes us next. Verse 3 through verse 11. Speaking of us, who are we in comparison to God? You return man to dust and say, "Return, O children of man. For 1,000 years in your sight are as but yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. You sweep them away as with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. For we are brought to an end by your anger. By your wrath we are dismayed. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath. We bring our years to an end like a sigh. The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet our span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away. Who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? God is infinite. Who are we? We are finite. Humans are finite. We are limited. We are flawed. We are temporary. We're not all powerful. We can't do whatever we want. Even though we're falsely told that, do you pay attention to what you're told? Do you pay attention to the self-glory messages that you receive? The you can do it, you can accomplish whatever you want, grab life by the tail, you have the power within you. Do you pay attention to that? You're being told that all the time. But it's not true. You can be positive. You can be a positive thinker. You can sit in a lotus position and hum all day long. But positive people die too. That is the reality of the human condition. The text reminds us that we are dust. What is my constitution? It's dust. Where does the psalmist point us back to when he declares that? He points us back to the opening chapters of our Bible. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 19, God says, you're going to return to the dust. This is why ministers of the gospel at funerals will say, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And we pour a little sand or a dusty substance on the casket. The casket might be rather attractive, made it of special metals, expensive wood, having expensive bouquets of flowers on it. Pretties death up a little bit. But in actual fact, we are dust. Our lives are blips. We come and we soon go. And in that journey, we disappoint our holy God. That is why the text on multiple occasions speaks of God's wrath. Because we disappoint the holy, sacred, beautiful God that created us. The passage also is very real. It reminds us of how difficult, how troublesome, how challenging life can be. We know what that's like. The challenges of managing money and relationships and health deficits and all of that. Life is challenging. If we knew in advance, it's like, who's going to sign up for that? Life is challenging. And what is amazing then about God is that the one who is divine and who is eternal would take an interest in dust to be objects of his affection and favor. That is amazing. That is incredible. Think about for a few more minutes your own finitude. Our service today will be about 75 minutes long. 75 minutes long. And during that 75 minute window, statisticians tell us that around the world, 7,895 people will die and pass off into eternity. 7,895 people are dying every 75 minutes globally. And it doesn't slow down in the afternoon or take a break in the evening hours. That's 24/7. 365 days a year, and that number increases as the population increases. Almost 8,000 people heading off into eternity while we meet for worship in one service at our church this morning. Statisticians further tell us that the average world lifespan is 70.5 years. I guess God's pretty good at math. Several of you, I would imagine, are in the healthcare industry. We're thankful for you, but you're not helping us much. This psalm was written hundreds of years before Jesus. And yet, in light of all the medical advancements, all of the degrees that have been earned in biology, medicine, nursing, the healthcare, social services agency, we still have not been able to advance the average human lifespan beyond 70 years worldwide. By way of strength, the text tells us some people make it a little longer. And our jaws drop. We're like, wow. When we see the announcement that someone has made 100, we're like, wow. There was a lady in France, apparently lived till 122. We're like, wow, that's long. No, it's just a blip. Just a little longer blip. But it's really not that long overall. Let me give you another statistic in the form of percentages. Thinking of percentages. What percentage of people sin? It's an impressive statistic. 100% of people sin. And therefore, 100% of people are justly deserving of the wrath of God spoken of in the text. It's amazing what the statistics are. We all die. Our lives are short. People are dying all the time. And all of us sin. It makes arrogance absolutely hilarious. What a joke. How many of you have ever ran a marathon? I know of at least one. Come on. A few of you. Anybody on this side? A few of you? A few people have ran a marathon. How long is a marathon? It's like in Canadian, it's 42.1, I think it's 98 kilometers. 42 point something kilometers. Check this out. Fastest time ever to run a full marathon, the world record, 2 hours, 1 minute, 39 seconds. It's pretty fast. Must have eaten his Wheaties that day. But suppose you were invited to run a marathon. To participate in a marathon, you're invited to. And here's the rules. The rules of the game are all you have to do is finish for a $5,000 prize. We're going to make it super easy. You can run it, you can walk it, or you can ride your bike. Pick your choice. No matter how fast or how slow, you'll get $5,000 at the end. You just have to compete in the marathon. Let's make it even more pleasant. Along the way, there's going to be more Gatorade than you could possibly ever want, some jelly donuts, your food of choice. There's going to be plenty of way stations you can stop. You can hang out for a few hours if you want. There's going to be some lazy boys along the route. And massage therapists lining up. If you want to stop, the leg, do you mind? No problem. You can run, you can walk, you can ride your bike. All you got to do is finish. It's going to be good. However, what you need to know is that at the end of receiving your $5,000, you're going to be executed for not running it in 30 minutes, which no human being will ever, ever do. So here's the question. That's the scenario. I want to ask you this question. Would you run? Would you walk or would you ride your bike? Have you decided? Who cares? Who cares? You're going to be dead at the end of it. Doesn't matter how fast you run, how enjoyable it is, how much leisure time you have, how many massages you get along the way. At the end of the 42K, you are dead. That's life. You can run through it. You can walk through it. You can have someone carry you through it. You can get fed. But at the end of the day, for all the paychecks and the rewards and the accolations that you might get, you will die. That's the story of life. And the statistics are impressive. There's not a person in this room that's going to be here a century from now. It's not a person on earth that's going to be here probably more than 122 years from now. That's the reality of the human condition. And no matter what you do to try to fix that, not going to think about it, going to avoid it, going to try to skirt my way around it, going to work out a little more, put on a little more lipstick and rouge, wear skinny jeans, you're going to die. But what if you were told that at any point in the race, prior to completing it, if you simply asked for a pardon, that you would not die at the end of the race? How many of you would ask for the pardon? Be asking for the pardon. That's the gospel. We're on our way to death. Death is inevitable, but eternal death does not need to be our lot if we simply ask for a pardon from God. Ask that the one who has run the race and finished it well, that his time, his reward, would be granted to us too. That's the gospel. The perfection of Christ put on my name. End of the race. What's your time, Aaron? 30 minutes. Impressive. And then Jesus has his initials beside it. This is where the psalmist pushes us. The infinitude of God, the finitude of man, and the pardon that we must seek. Verse 12 and 13. So teach us, look at the cry, I realize I'm dust. Lord, teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Teach me to use my life productively. Help me to steward my life productively. When it says here, teach us to number our days, to number one's days means to keep track of one's days. Not just in some mathematical sense, but in a stewardship kind of way. I'm going to look at my life. I'm going to give it a proper assessment. I'm going to say I'm not guaranteed one more day, but I'm going to number this day as a day within which I have honored the Lord. That's what it means to honor, or to teach us to number our days. That we may what? That we may get a heart of wisdom. Wisdom transcends knowledge, and that wisdom is the proper and skillful application of knowledge. And what do we know? We know we're dying. We know God is infinite. We know that he is gracious. And then we have verse 13, speaking of presence, return, O Lord, how long? Have pity on your servants. This is a call to have God be with us, to manifest himself, and then to have pity on us, to remove our sins from us. There's a lot of fear associated naturally, and there should be, with being finite. Uh-oh, I got a lump on my neck. You ever had that? I got a lump on my neck, or something's not right in here, or man, I don't know if I feel right. Could I be dying? Could it be cancer? It's like automatically, I'm afraid. You hear of shootings, you hear of murders, you hear of pollution drifting across the river. You're like, is this going to cut my life short? There's like a fear of death. That's natural. But supernaturally, we are able to overcome that because when we call upon God to have pity on his servants, we encounter infinitude. God, who is willing to call us unto himself, who is willing to have relationship with us. That's the proper response when the finite encounters the infinite, God. And then it goes from there. So teach us, return to us, have pity on us. Verse 14, satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Look at the sequence there. We're satisfied. We get up in the morning and we're like, what am I going to do today? I got a lot of things to do, but I'm going to make sure I'm putting my satisfaction in God. Now, there's nothing wrong with finding a measure of temporal satisfaction in the things of this life. Good food, good family, good fellowship, good friends. But that's a small S satisfaction. Capital S satisfaction is only found when we come close to the Lord. And we're called upon to do that every morning at the beginning of each new day. That's part of numbering your days. So I'm satisfied in God. The reason why I'm able to be satisfied is because his love is steadfast. Nobody else has the kind of steadfast love that God does. The result is we rejoice. We find ourselves positionally gladdened all of our days. Verse 15, make us glad. Picking up on that theme again, make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us and for as many years as we have seen evil. There's a sense of compensation there. Lord, I've not been enjoying this. Compensate me with this. I've experienced these pains and trials. Compensate me with these blessings. That's what the psalmist cries out to the Lord. Compensate me, Lord. Make us glad. Verse 16, let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Teach us, return to us, have pity on us, satisfy us, offer us gladness, show us your glory. Let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. I really find quite encouraging that last statement because I find it to be so visionary. He's looking ahead. The glory that we have seen, Lord, let my children see it too. Let my grandchildren see it too. Let my descendants see it too. It's natural. The older we get, the greater our hearts are for those that are coming after us. That's natural. So I'm kind of middle of the way through life. Realistically, using the number 70, I'm probably about 60% used up. And as I grow older, some of you are older than me. You've told me this too. You look back. You're looking ahead, like you're planning things out. You still have some dreams and hopes, but you're super enthused when those that come after you are growing in the faith, are following the Lord, when God is pouring out his power and his glory upon them. That's encouraging. That should be the case. So the 20-year-old, they're theoretically aware of the reality of their own pending demise. The 30-year-old becomes a little more aware of it. The 40-year-old aware. The 50-year-old more aware. That we become more and more aware of our own finitude. But because we've seen God be faithful and show his glory, we become more and more excited and enthusiastic that the younger generation would see it as well. That's where the psalmist's mind goes. Let your work be shown to your servants. We want it too, Lord. We want to see your glory and your glorious power to their children. Having encountered the Lord, he wants future generations to see and hear the Lord as well. I do not know when Jesus is going to come back. He might come back 1 second from now. He didn't. But he could. He might come back right now. He didn't, but he could. He could come back anytime. We always got to be prepped for that. But we're not presumptuous. We don't know when. And so as we do ministry, it's wise for us to always position ourselves to be a blessing to the next, to the generations that follow us. So here we are. Some people poured their time and talents and treasures into this church long before some of you were even believers, even before some of you were born. And here's our time in history. This is our day. And God has entrusted us with time, talents, and treasures, and we're pouring it into ministry. We're going to put a big building over there so that we might make more disciples. We're going to build it a little bigger than we need right now because we're doing it with the next generation in mind, with future disciples in mind. We want future disciples to see God glorified, and we're trusting the Lord then to show his continued glory, and through our efforts to build a prevailing church that will impact lives for many generations to come. Is that your heartbeat? It's increasingly my heartbeat. People poured into me. I want to pour into the next generation and position our church for many years to come, unless Jesus returns to preach and share the gospel in this city. So today we're here and we get to be part of history. Now, we're always part of history, but we get to be part of a history that God is building and blessing. A history that is part of an experience of divine favor. We're part of history right now. We have something big in front of us that God has entrusted to us to display his favor. We want to steward it for his honor and for his glory. Not because we're naive to the fact that everything goes back to dust, but because during our lives, God does continue to show his manifest presence and his manifest glory, and we want more and more people to experience that as well.